The following presentation was recorded at the 1996 Teachers Workshop at Faith Builders. More information on Faith Builders events at fbep.org.
A builder builded a temple.
He wrought it with grace and skill, pillar and groin and arches, all fashioned to work his will. Men said as they saw its beauty, "It shall never know decay. Great is thy skill, O builder, thy fame shall endure for aye." A mother builded a temple with loving and infinite care, planning each arch with patience, laying each stone with prayer. None praised her unceasing effort. None knew of her wondrous plan. But the temple the mother builded was unseen by the eyes of man. Gone is the builder's temple, crumpled into the dust. Low lies each stately pillar, food for consuming rust. But the temple the mother builded will last while the ages roll, for that beautiful, unseen temple is a child's immortal soul. That's what we're dealing with, isn't it? A child's immortal soul. If you have a student and they're a shining academic success, but they end up going to hell, what was it all about? Isn't that true? What was it all about? The time you spent teaching that child, you might as well have been taking a nap or drinking iced tea. And I think that's why we're all here. So we welcome you. I'm humbled by the fact that you came. I assume that most or all of you have taught, and you have probably had the same thoughts that I'm thinking right now, that it would probably be more edifying if I were there and one of you were here. You ever think that with your students? I always think of what John told the people that came to him. What'd you come for? I mean, you left your homes back in Jerusalem and you wandered all the way down that Jericho road, hot, old, dusty, dirty road, wandered over to the Jordan River. What for? What'd you do that for? I would like to submit to you, and these are just some general things, that coming here will change your life. Not because it's Faith Builders, but it's any time that God's people get together and they talk about a common cause, I think it will change your life. It will change your life, if you let it. I think of the song, "Break Thou the Bread of Life to me, dear Lord, today." We don't eat a whole loaf at a time. It's one bite at a time. And that's the way we learn. That's what Isaiah 28 says. Line upon line, precept upon precept, line upon line, precept upon precept. Here a little, there a little. And that's the way we all learn. It is rare that in a day or a week or even a course at college that you learn a bunch of God. That might happen. It's happened to me on rare occasions. But mostly we learn a little bit here and a little bit there. When I was going to college, I would hear the guys stand around and talk about how this course was really not worth that much and the teacher was not really teaching us all that much, and they would stand around and foul-mouth this on and on. And one day I listened to this and I asked them, I said, "How'd you guys get so wise going to these dumb classes?" You know, and that's a bad stance, and I don't mean that you have it, but I just want to encourage you, to encourage your students to have a positive attitude about going to class and learning. If you learn one little thing today, it was worth your time to be here. Because one little thing can change your life. A child's immortal soul. I hope that that echoes through your mind today. There's a story in 2 Kings 8, and it always touches me. It's the story of Elisha and Hazael. Hazael was a lieutenant, a trusted friend of King Ben-Hadad of Syria. One time the Lord told Elisha to go to Damascus. That was the capital of Syria. And he went there, and the king was sick. Thought he might die. And so the king sent his best friend, Hazael. He heard Elisha was in town. He said, go ask Elisha what's going to happen to me. And so Haziel went and talked to Elisha. And it's interesting, this is kind of an aside, but Elisha and Elijah were two entirely different characters in this, that everybody always knew where Elisha was. Anytime you wanted to know what Elisha had to say about something, everybody knew where he was. He lived in Dothan. He had a home. All you had to do is knock on his door, and there he was. Elijah, nobody ever knew where he was. In fact, the only time he showed up was when nobody wanted him around. It's interesting to read the accounts of Elijah. When they wanted him, he was nowhere to be found. When they didn't want him around, then there he was. Anyway, Haziel knocks on Elisha's door and says, the king sent me, and he wants to know if he's going to live or die. And Elisha said, he's going to live, but he's going to die. That must have helped a lot. And then the part that's touching is Elisha looked at that man and wept. Haziel says, what's wrong? And he says, because I know what you're going to do to the children of Israel when you get to be king. And Haziel objected to that. You know what he did the next day? He went and killed Ben-Hadad. It says he went and suffocated him. Killed his best friend. And when I look at a child that's in trouble, mostly spiritually, it makes you want to weep because you know what the end of that road is, what that path is. Who owns a child? You ever wonder about that? Who owns a child? Anybody? Who owns a child? Anybody know? You don't know? Speak to me. Who owns a child? God ultimately owns a child. Under God, he's loaned them to us on earth. So who on earth is the most responsible for a child? Who basically, on an earthly way, owns a child? The parents. You know, it's easy for a teacher to think that they do. But when we appear before God, God is not going to hold us accountable for this child. He's going to hold us accountable for what we did to him. But the child belongs to the parent. And I think that has far-reaching implications to us as teachers. Sometimes we think at school, you're at school now, you're not at home, you need to do what I want you to do. And I know there's a place for that, but we always, as teachers, need to be sensitive to the desires of the parent. We are servants. Did you ever think about how many people you're servants to? Let's just think about that a little bit. In Matthew 20, Jesus said he didn't come to be ministered unto. He didn't come to be served, but he came to serve. Isn't that where we are? We're not a master. Who's our master? Who are we servant to? Anybody? We're servant to God, obviously. I don't know if that shows up very good. Can you read that? Would another color do better? Let's try blue. Does that show up better? Maybe so. Okay. Who else? Who are we servant to? The parents. We're just a servant of the parents. Who else? Society. We have an obligation to society. You can take that society at large, church society, whatever. Who else are we servant to? Church? Who else? Students. We're a servant to the student. You know that in Greek and Roman times, the time when the Bible was sent, who were the teachers? Who did the rich Roman people have for teachers of their students? They were slaves, Greek slaves. It was very common. They were slaves. So we're a servant to the students. Who else are we a servant to? Who do you work for? Who pays your check? School board. We're just a servant. Anybody else?
Well, in Guatemala, the board, the administrator, maybe the principal, we go through all that.
We're just a servant. And I would just encourage you to think about that. I am just a servant. That doesn't mean that I don't have responsibilities. That doesn't mean that I don't have a mind of my own. It doesn't mean that my will and wishes are totally ignored, but in the ultimate test, we are a servant. And that brings us to the thing of work. What does a servant do? He works. School is work. If you're going to be a teacher, it's work. And I am convinced, and you may have a different experience, but I can only speak out of my own experience, but I am convinced that there a minimum of 10 hours a day must be spent by a successful teacher. Minimum. People say to me, you're working too hard, you're spending too much time, why don't you let me come help you? Well, there are some things that people can do if you're spending time vacuuming the floor, you can get somebody vacuuming the floor. And but people say, can I grade test for you? Is that, can people grade test for you? But do you realize how much contact you lose with a student who's available for a test? You've lost something right there. You've lost an insight as to where that student is academically, maybe even spiritually. You've lost a clue. And so I grade my own tests. I want to know whether it's handwriting, whether it's the kind of answers they give or don't give. I just want to know the whole thing. Part of what a student is what he does. And the key to what he does many times is the tests that we see. As a teacher, we should not give up that. In the whole scheme of things, with all these that were that are our masters, that means if you're going to really serve a master, what do you need to do? You need to know his every whim and wish. I taught one time with a teacher that had taught a lot longer than I had, and he encouraged students to respond to their teacher's whims. And he was right, and we need to respond to the people above us. For instance, if you have a teacher and you know that a big thing with them is promptness, if you know that a big thing with him, and this man, for instance, this just comes to my mind right now, he cannot stand. There is a proper way to staple things together. And let me say, boy, that is very detailed. Well, it is, but that was a big deal with him. And when a student wouldn't staple, 45 degrees across that corner, he meant to be stable. And so the students that were watching this, he likes that staple. I kind of like that too. So I kind of think I like that. I tell my students, when I say to stay out of bed when you're good, I say, it'd be better if you staple that thing. And it's just a whim of the teacher. Respond to those whims. We need to respond at the same time that students need to see us respond to the whims, or whatever you want to call them, of the people above us. And that may even include them. So you must intimately know your master. If you're a servant, you must have a master. And if that includes, and it does, the parents, then the more you know about the family of each student, the better equipped you are to teach that student. It may give you an insight as to where the parent is coming from. So hopefully we can all learn something today. Just remember that a teacher must be a learner, and I think that's why you're here, and I admire you for spending time and for coming and being here. Now, we want to look at basically four areas today with a reference to this subject. One of them is the parents' academic expectations. That's probably the biggest one. We want to look at the parents' desires concerning restrictions and just unique things that parents prefer, parents' preferences. That's number two. We want to look at the spiritual, social desires and uniqueness of each student. Depending if you teach in a school where children come from different churches, like I do, there's probably 12 different churches represented in the school where I teach. The more I know about those, the better things go. And then we want to look at the limits of the school. Before we do that, let's just look at this thing of the parents, since that's who we probably have the most communication with. I want to just share this with you. There are all kinds of parents. So what kind of parents are you dealing with? And when we realize what kind of parents we're dealing with, it makes us more compassionate on the student. On the subject of parent expectations, it may give us a clue as to why certain children act the way they do. I have already been very upset with a student, and by the time I heard their story and talked to their parent, I ended up being on the student's side. I mean, when I realized where they were coming from, all the frustrations that they had, what they were facing at home, it kind of made me feel sorry for them, and I understood what they were doing. And there are basically, and you can do this, you could make two, I suppose, you could make four or five or whatever. In this little scheme of things, there's four kinds of parent. There's the permissive giveaway. There's the parent that does not put any controls on their children. And when you understand that, for this child, I had a boy at one time, and I was talking about curfew with a bunch of high schoolers, and this young man told me, and I just picked him out, and I said, "Mark, what's your curfew?" He said, "I don't have one." And I said, "Really? You don't have one?" I said, "What happened if you come home at 2 o'clock in the morning?" "Well, my mother might ask me where I'd been if she was awake." I'm saying it about the way he said it. See, he had no control on his life. That boy's still in trouble. Right today. That was 15 years ago. Still in trouble. No controls. So how's that boy going to get along at school? You got him in your classroom. He doesn't know what it is to have a curfew. He doesn't know what it is to be a deadline. In fact, in the case of this family, he doesn't know what it is to get school on time. You have to deal with that. You either have to deal with it and help him, or kick him out. You're going to kick a student out because he doesn't get to school on time? No, he needs help. But where's all that rooted? It's rooted in the family. There's the uninterested, the non-helper. You send homework home, doesn't do it. Student doesn't do it. Send it home again, doesn't do it. You call the parent and say, "Did you know Johnny had some homework? And, you know, he hasn't been doing it." "Well, I guess maybe I did know. I don't know." I had one young man ask him, "So what happened to your homework? Where's your light unit?" He said, "Couldn't find it this morning. I think Mother started a fire with it." So he said, "I don't know, annoying her, she may have it." I mean, totally. Is that child going to get any help at home? So you're sending homework home. What's the chance of it getting done? Anybody? Zero. So what are you going to do? See, you're faced with that. So does that mean the child doesn't have to do any homework? And that's what it is homework. You're not responsible for homework. I tell parents that all the time. They think I'm responsible for homework. I say, no, that's what's called homework. I'm not responsible. I'm responsible as a teacher for seeing that it gets home, that it's clear to the parent what is to be done, but I am not responsible for a child doing homework. Unless maybe you get one like this, then what are you going to do? What are you going to do? And that's what you're dealing with. Is this too far? You have parents like that? Am I making any sense to you? I mean, that's what we're up against. Then there's the person that is a bureaucratic guardian. You can put other words to these. And, I mean, they follow the rules. And this child is so confused. First place, he's not even sure what all the rules are, but he knows that if he breaks one, then he will know what it is. And very authoritarian, no give and take, no mercy. And when the child comes to school, with usually that's a father, but not always, what does he expect you to be like? Huh? Yeah, same way. That's what he's used to dealing with. And so you treat them with compassion, you treat them with a little bit of grace, and that confuses them more. Now he's really confused. And he's never met anything like this. You know, and right away they'll interpret it. Oh, this guy's soft touch, you don't need to do anything. But you have to deal with that. That's what. And it all roots back to the parent. When you understand that, then it gives you a little bit of better basis to work with the child. So what is, and then there's the genuine helper, and we have a lot of those. I mean, the parents that are on top of everything. I had one set of parents, this is an extreme, that mother went through every light unit. When that child was true with it and took it home, that mother went through every light unit to see that everything was done right. And if there was something wasn't scored right or something I missed, she would tell me. I mean, she... And those children knew it, and these children, I mean, they were happy. They weren't, you say, boy, no, these children, they appreciated their mother. You ask them about their mother today, and they'd say, she's a great mother. I mean, she loved them, and she wasn't doing it in the wrong way. She was helping them. Now, that's the extreme, but those children performed. They did their work right, because they knew mom was going to check it, whether the teacher did or not. So you could go through these, how you need to react to each one, and we probably won't have time to do all of that, but the key to it is, and that is one duty that we don't always think of as teachers. Do you realize that when you're teaching children, one of your primary duties is you're teaching parents? Do you ever think about that? I have parents say, my child won't do this, they won't pick up their clothes. How do you teach a child to pick up their clothes? See, you're a teacher and a parent that is not, they expect you to have all the answers for all of these. And the key to this, one of the keys to this is, and I have it down here, the top secret info, when we move for the good, we move other people with us. And in the case of a parent, if you can move a parent, then they're going to move their children, they're going to improve their school. And that's true of us individually. Anytime we improve ourselves, anytime we make corrections in our life and become more like Jesus Christ, we help other people become more like Jesus Christ. It's just a fact of human life. Jesus was a people mover. And we can be too. So how about this thing of academic expectations? Well, the first thing that obviously comes to mind is basic subjects. What do parents expect? They expect to send their child to school and he learns how to read and write and cipher and all those things. They expect that. And they expect that no matter what they send. That's what we're faced with. No matter what they send, they have a very definitive, that's the word I want, expectation of what they expect to get back, don't they? Do you ever notice that? What they sent to them is some kind of blurry, but what they expect back is very clear to them. And I don't say that that's bad. I think that they have a right to expect something. So they have expectations in the basic subjects. And usually, and we're not going to spend much time on this, because usually that's the easiest thing to do. If you're a teacher, you know how to add. You know how to teach addition. You know algebra. You know how to teach it. Whatever it is, you know the 8 parts of speech, or 10, or however many of them that you want to make. I think Bob Jones makes 10 out of them. But whatever, you know that. You know how to teach it, and you can impart that to them. Now, getting them to accept it might be another thing. Because, maybe in the next lecture we'll get into that more, a very good case can be made for the fact that no real learning takes place unless it takes place in the heart. No real learning takes place. And that really puts a lot of pressure on a Christian teacher. You see, in the public school, you're not concerned with that. You impart the information to them, they take it or leave it. I have a nephew just about a mile and a half down the road from us, teaches at a public high school. They said when it was built, it was the most expensive high school in the United States. They spent $60 million on that high school. He teaches there, and all he has to do is give knowledge, give them the opportunity to learn,
And if Joe over here doesn't want to learn, and three times in the day he disrupts the class, he can say, Joe, here's a slip of paper. This is the only thing to do. His obligation is over. What happens to Joe is no concern. We're not in that shape. That is not where we are. And so, as we are teaching this knowledge, we have the added responsibility of attempting, doing our best to see that it is internalized. And that really comes up with the second thing, and we're under this thing of parents' expectations academically. Number one, they have expectations for the basics, but maybe there's a second thing under that, more importantly, they should have, and I think they do have, expectations and attitude and skills with reference to study. And I thought about it this way. If I wrote down and I said, here's a young man that's going to come out of high school, or woman, girl, doesn't make any difference. Could you define for me what a successful high schooler is? What should they know? I mean, here, you say, well, they got out of high school and they couldn't read. And we hear all the stories, and a lot of them are true, and we need to be careful it's not true of us, but we know what a high schooler shouldn't be. Do we know what they should be? What should they know? Is it important? Should I turn that thing this way? What is important that they know? If you was going to list 10 things, somebody tell me one. What's important? What should a high schooler know when he gets out of high school? What, describe for me a high schooler that is ready for whatever's before. They should be able to express themselves, writing or speaking. Yeah, so we'll just leave it there, writing and speaking. They need to be able to communicate, is really what you're saying. What else? What would you like? You're a 35, 40-year-old father, and your son or daughter is getting out of high school. What would you like for them to know? Respect. Can we just leave it? Respect? How about respect for God's creation? Just the general appreciation, respect for everything. Right. Respect for their mother. Like for them to be respectful, maybe that'd be better. Three, what else? What? Should have some work skills. And work attitude. Can we call it that? Now, some of you that have been here have heard me tell this, that this last year, the sister that I taught with, she got a panel of parents together. She had the high schoolers in her writing class decide what job they wanted to apply for. In other words, the girls that could apply for a receptionist if they wanted, or a school teacher, or a nurse, or whatever. They could decide what they wanted to be interviewed for, and then she had this board of parents interviewing. So they would have the experience of a job interview, and this panel asked them all kinds of questions. And it would turn out to be a tremendous thing for the parents that served and for the children. I mean, they did a lot of talking about it. But out of that, the board told me, with reference to one young man, they said we would have hired him for anything. I mean, he convinced them, seriously, that he liked to work. And they said, well, why do you like to work? And he said, my mother likes to work, and my dad likes to work, and I like to work. I just like to do things. And they said, we'd have hired him for anything. Work skills. When I worked for the city of Modesto, we hired a young man for the survey team. He had a degree in mathematics from a local college. He couldn't get a job. He was a handsome young man, a very athletic-looking young man. And it turned out that he was totally worthless. In the 13 years I worked in the city of Modesto, he's the only person that I know of that got fired. and took 2 years to fire him. There's a civil service. It was totally worthless. The party chief told him and said, we get more done when he isn't even around. I just assumed he'd be in the office. It's totally worthless. Handsome, nice body, good brain, nice degree, but worthless. What else? There's a couple big things that we haven't even talked about yet. What else?
Be able to learn.
Be able to learn, just study skills. You know, what's more important than knowing a fact? What is more important than knowing a fact? What?
No, but I want to forget the fact. But if I can remember where to find it, then I got something, right?
Then I got something. And they ask me all the time, you know, this is ridiculous, but children ask, and they must use it, they ask me all the time, how do you spell? Whatever. What do I say? Huh?
Go to the dictionary. I know how to spell it, but you need to learn. That dictionary is right there.
And when they're in high school, just as a quick thing, I encourage them to have a dictionary at their desk. I have already sent out notices that if a grandparent or a parent wants to buy a child something, buy them a good dictionary. Because I found out at my own desk, if I have to get out of my chair to get the dictionary, I am extremely reluctant. Because all of us, whether we want to admit it or not, are basically lazy. But if I have it right there, where I reach out and get it, I'll pick it up. You need to have critical things handy. What else? Good morning. How to get along. Boy, does any scriptures come to mind? Does any church problems come to mind? Does any societal problems come to mind? Just get along. Oh, yeah, big one. We'll just put no God. That's that word, like in John 3, John 17, 3. This is life eternal, that I might know thee, the only true God. That word is genosko. That doesn't mean just know about God. It means to have a relationship with God. It's more than head knowledge. Know God. Probably ought to put a... What else? Can you think of anything else? With this one, for a high schooler, get along with, well, everybody, but certainly his peers, know how to treat a girl, know how to treat a boy, all kinds of things. With what else do they need? Well, they need basic academic skills, right? I mean, you're not worth too much in this day and age. You can't read and write. Basic academic skills. What else? What? Needs to have some vision for the future, right? Well, can you have any other kind of vision? What do you think, John? That's the only kind of vision. What else? Anything else? We talked about respect, respectful. And this needs to be controlled, but how about self-respect? When somebody isn't clean, all kinds of just personal things, so they, I always think, they must not respect themselves. They lack some self-respect. I'm thinking of a girl that her slip's always hanging out, and she gets to school with a dress that has all the buttons on, I'm ready to shout hallelujah. Safety pins are fine, but they ought to be temporary. Young man always got his shirt tail out and all kinds of things. Just self-respect. Just clean, wash their hair. And that doesn't mean twice a day like some of them do. Is there anything else? Maybe we got them all. Well, you could go on and on, right? All kinds of things. Now, how do you do that? And that's what parents basically respect. That's what expect.
That's what we're after. And you see, the academic part of it, in a way, is very small. In fact, I just got a fax this morning from our administrator. See, we've been gone from home since June 2nd. And school at home is kind of in turmoil a little because there's a lot of new students coming. We have new teachers, and there's just a lot of things going on, and I'm not there. By the way, those of you that don't know me, I probably should have told you, I do teach school. I'm a pastor of a congregation. I've taught school either 17 years or this is the 17th year, I'm not sure which. I am the principal also at the school where I am. It'll have 50 to 60 students this year. It's the second school that I have taught in. And there's this boy who, Henry, who's a foster boy, and he has really struggled. And according to the facts, he's not coming back. He's kind of given up, which is really a sad thing. Because he lacks some self-respect. His mother is a prostitute in town, and he has no idea who his father is. He's never seen him. We spent a lot of time and a lot of prayer, and his foster parents have. It's just a difficult thing. But he lacks self-respect. He really does not know for sure who he is or where he's going. So academic expectations may go beyond the basic subjects. That's our point in all this. And they may be the most important thing that you teach. And just think about that. But parents expect all of those things. They expect for their high schooler to come out of high school, being able to express themselves, being respectful of them, with some work skills and good attitude, with some study skills, how to get along with people. We had some real go-arounds with that last year. They expect them to they'll know God and they know about God. That's why they're sending them to a Christian school. They expect them to know how to do the basics academically. They want them to have some vision for the future. And certainly, self-respect. And you, all you'd have to do is go to one of your cities, and if that doesn't do it for you, come out our way and I'll take you down to San Francisco and you can see whole gangs of people that have no self-respect. The third thing is special requests. And I know that most schools don't respond to this possibly the way we do, but we have children from different churches, and for instance, I think that we need to respect special requests. And what I mean by that is this. We have a family that is Dutch Reformed, that sends their children to our school. Their father is a high school teacher, a public high school teacher, just the opposite way than my nephew. We're all three on the same road. But he does not want his children going to that high school, and for good reasons. But he wants them to do their church's Bible course. He does not want them to do our Christian Light Bible course. And it would be easy to say, well, you're going to this school, and I don't want to hassle all that, but we don't do that. And it is really, I feel very good about that, and I think there's no question in my mind but what it has influenced that man's attitude, not only about our school, but about us as a people, that we're cooperative. If you want your daughter to do your son to do your Bible things, that's fine with me. What can I do to help you? And we need to have that kind of an attitude. The fourth thing under academic that I want to encourage you in is this thing of comprehensive interviews, scheduled interviews at least twice a year. It's interesting to me that since I was here, I became aware that that's not necessarily the case. In fact, one person that taught said, well, our interviews last 10 minutes. They scheduled 10 minutes per interview. And I said, well, in our interviews, we're just getting done saying hello in 10 minutes. I scheduled 1 hour. And I figure if I'm going to take the time and disrupt my evening schedule for a week or two, and that's what it takes me, 2 weeks, then we're going to make this a worthwhile interview. And it is absolutely amazing what I've learned about parents and children in the course of that interview. And I just want to encourage you, if you really want to know what's going on in a family, if you really want to know what their doubts and fears are, if you really want to know what their stresses are, then you need to get to know them. And it may be your neighbor, it may be somebody you've grown up with all your life. And in the course of an interview, it's amazing what all comes out. We talk about all kinds of things. And I like to give that extra time because at the end of it, I say, is there anything else you want to talk about? And I would say three-fourths of the time for parents, they want to bring up a church issue, they want to bring up a social issue, they want to bring up a theological issue, they want to talk about something else. And it's a great time to get them home. When I do an interview, I ask certain questions, and I'm very closely watching and how that young man talks to his mother. Now, I don't make that obvious, but I do, and it's amazing what you learn. A child's reaction to their parent, particularly if there's a little bit of a problem. There are a lot of hints as to what's going on in a family. And you see, no matter how this child, remember we said, came to school, they expect them. This is a Christian school, isn't it? Don't you teach Christian values? They expect this child to come back home speaking kindly to their mother if they didn't do that before. You say, well, who said that was the job of the Christian school? Well, God did, I guess. It is. So this thing of a comprehensive interview, there are all kinds of things. You need to ask the parents their opinion about things. Do you know how valuable it is to ask people's opinion about things, if you really mean it? And some of the best suggestions that we've ever gotten, we've gotten from parents. They need to know up front that you may not be able to do what they ask, but they need to know that you listened and that you thought about it. It's building a relationship with the parents. And I've gotten an excellent reaction out of that. The other thing that we need to do is to offer help for those that struggle. And you know, I hear teachers say, nothing more I can do. I don't know what to do with this kid. It's just hopeless. And I don't believe that. There's always one more thing that you can do. In fact, I would submit to you that if you can only teach the teachable, you're not really a teacher. You realize, have you ever looked at your students and looked at them and thought, how many of them really don't even need you? We had a young man that left our school, a very intelligent young man, very self-disciplined. He went to college, he became an aeronautical engineer, and he went to work in Seattle for Boeing. And everybody, well, not everybody, a lot of people said, well, that's a real feather in your hat, isn't it? And I said, no, it's a feather in his hat. He didn't need me. He would have learned, and he said, he was an intelligent boy and he was self. How many of your students don't even need you? If that's the only kind of people we can teach, we're not really teachers. Did Jesus come just for the good? Did you ever think it? You know, we say, well, I don't want to have to deal with this rabble, this one that can't learn or won't learn. Well, that's what Jesus came for. He said, the whole, the good, they don't need me. They don't need a physician. Now, how do you do that? Well, we have 10 minutes left. We might spend a little bit of time on that. What are the causes? Why does a child struggle? And remember, if you can take a child that is struggling and turn them around, get them to like school, you have made a friend, a supporter, an encourager forever. There was a young man who came to our school. His parents had talked to his son. He didn't go to our church. He goes to a Grace Brethren church. And they had talked some about sending him. And they did it this one year when school started. And halfway through the year, they called and they wanted to send him. It was a good family. We had known the family. We'd grown up with them in years past. And the thing that did it for him, for them, and this boy was a fine boy. He had a little bit of troubles in some things, but nothing big. And we tutored him one summer, and we're all great friends. It really turned out good, and I realize this is a success story, and I can tell you some that aren't. But the thing that did it, and I want to tell you this story. The father said the reason we're sending him is he was having trouble at school again, which he always had, of getting along with the other boys. Well, that don't sound very good. You're taking a student that can't get along with other boys. But the principal called him in for an interview, and the principal finally told the father, he said, do you really want to know what Jay's problem is? And the father said, well, yeah, tell me. He said, he isn't vulgar enough to get along with the other boys. And his dad thought, he's vulgar enough for me. It's time he goes somewhere else. You see, when the other boys talked about things that shouldn't be talking about, he didn't enter in, so he was an outcast. He wasn't interested in that. He just naturally wasn't. He's a good boy. But he did have some other problems that we could respond to. You need to think about why are they, what is the problem with this child learning? They might be just naturally slow or methodical. Some people can decide in a moment's notice something, and other people want to think about it 2 days. Now, if you're in a restaurant and ordering food, that's a problem. You need to make up your mind. But there's people that way. All you have to do is look around and look at your students, and you can see some of them, if you say, who wants to? Yeah, I'll go. And others, they're sitting there thinking, you know, and 2 days later they say, I wish I would have, or whatever. There's some people that just not are not psychomotor oriented. They're just uncoordinated. And you say, well, what does that have to do with it? Well, when they go out on the playground and they find out that they can't hit the ball, and or they whatever, that affects them in the classroom because it puts them down and their self-worth goes down. That may be the only problem that they have. They might just be passively lazy. You know, they just haven't ever been woke up. They might be actively lazy, meaning they're going to make sure that they are. And there's a big difference. I'd rather work with the passively lazy one. He doesn't realize he is. I had a young man in high school one time told me, I'm not going to do any more than what I have to. And his dad sat right there at an interview and said, well, I'm not going to make him. Well, as a teacher, am I going to make him? I mean, if the boy isn't going to and the father isn't going to help, am I going to make him do any more than he has to? Nay, verily. That's a dead-end street. And so then we talked about, well, what is this line? What is the have to? And so we agreed on that, and we got it done. By the way, that boy wasn't out of school 2 years. He went back to college, and he personally apologized to me. He said, that was a mistake. And I said, well, I knew it, but thank you. Behind, for whatever reason, so disinterested and unmotivated. They can get behind, and if you had to go to classes every day where you were somewhere between 1 day and 1 year behind, and you didn't know what they were talking about, how interested would you be? You're going to go to that class every day. Oh, I got to get up and go to this class, and I'm back here at square C, and they're all up here at square M, and I am not going to know what's going on, but I got to go. Does that sound interesting? Would you get up and just jump out of bed and put on your clothes? And no, and they don't either. You can see it in their eyes. And so they may be behind because they're studying over their head. We must be careful as a teacher. We try to make something out of them that God did not intend for them to be. And parents may do that. They may expect you to teach this child algebra when I'm convinced there's certain children that God didn't wire their motherboard that way. You know, they will never learn it. And we might as well recognize it and not frustrate them and frustrate you and put you in the role of a failure. So there's all those reasons, and we need to investigate it and see why. And then you say, well, how do I do that? Well, to me, the key to all of this, of perceiving what kind of family we're dealing with, perceiving what kind of child we're dealing with, all can be summed up in one thing, and that's how sensitive your spirit is to other people's spirit. And you say, well, that's awful bad. Well, then it's bad. But that's the way it is. And that's the only way you can perceive what's going on with somebody else. If you have a sense of the Spirit, isn't that what Jesus had? Now, I realize we're not Jesus, but maybe we can become more like him than we give ourselves credit for. Let's not just rest on the laurel that Jesus was Jesus and I'm me. I think if we really work at it as teachers, we can become sensitive to our students and what's really going on inside, and that's the only way you'll know. Because they'll mask it all with all kinds of either laziness or over-aggressiveness on the playground, all kinds of things. There's some concepts that we, besides that one, that's number one, how do you deal with this kind of thing, a student that's behind for whatever of these reasons. Number one, you must have a sensitive spirit. Number one, we have to realize that a student must like you. Or whatever word you want to put there. You might put love, respect, admire, appreciate. You can put whatever word you want there, but mark this down for sure, that if a student doesn't like you as a teacher, he is not going to learn. Why do people learn from Jesus? He was a great guy. He touched their spirit. He gave them something that they needed. He gave them hope. And Jesus was not so concerned that woman was in the gutter as that which way she was headed. And as a teacher, we need to be that interested in the student. It's not how far down they are, but it's where we're moving them. We need to touch them and give them hope. If you can't give them hope, they're not going to want to get out of bed, and I wouldn't either. Number three, they have to view learning as relevant to some degree in their life, and that puts burden on the teacher again. They have to view learning as relevant to some degree in their life. Who wants to learn something that they're totally convinced is worthless? And so you need to appeal to their natural desires. If they're a hunter, then you need to relate physics to hunting. If they like to do woodwork, then you need to relate biology to woodwork and the grain in the wood or whatever. And I know that it can be done. You can do it with essays. One time a young man who was very down academically, in a Christian life, he had to write an essay and describe a topographical scene. Well, he didn't even know what that word meant. And so I told him what it meant, and that didn't help him out any. And he liked to hunt, and I knew he did. And I said, why don't you write down for me, when you step out of your dad's pickup, when you go hunting, what do you see? And he said, well, that's what they want. And I said, yeah, that's what they want. And he said, misspelled words and everything, but he could write the essay. He could be very, because that was very real to him, what he saw when he stepped out of his dad's pickup. They have to develop a sense of personal responsibility. And I don't have any magic for doing that, but we need to remember that, young man, I know how to write that essay. I know the eight parts of speech. I know how to do fractions. And I can't do it for you. You're the one that has to learn how to do it. That is your responsibility. I'll help you if you want to stay after school, whatever you want to do. You want to stay in at lunchtime, I'll stay in at lunchtime and help you. But remember this for sure, you are responsible for learning. I cannot learn for you. And they'll respond to that. But you need to enter the process by giving of your time. Now, they may not take you up on that, skipping lunch, but you've made the offer, and that alone has an impact on them. We need to remember what Aristotle, was that Alexander the Great's teacher, I think? Alexander one day got upset, and he said, I'm going to be king. Why do I have to learn this stuff?
And Aristotle said, young man, there is no royal road to learning. Just because you're a king, there is no royal road to learning.
Don't ever try to portray to your students that learning is enjoyable, learning is rewarding, but don't ever try to portray to them that learning is not work, because it is. Now, we've kind of gotten off of that parent expectation in a way, but it's on it in this. Parents, no matter what they send, expect you to send a child back that has these learning skills. That's why they sent them to your school. And there is much more that we could say, but the time is up. And one of our goals today is to stop on time.
For the most current Faith Builders recordings, visit christianlearning.org. And for more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit thedocforlearning.org.